Hello, and welcome to the second episode of the Connectivity Podcast. My name is Mattias Fridström, and I'm currently the chief evangelist at Telia Carrier. In the Connectivity Podcast, we talk to industry experts around connectivity and cloud and other connectivity services. Last time, we spoke to Mark Feely, the CEO of Edgevana, and in this second episode, we will continue to talk to Mark because we believe there are more questions we need to ask him. So last time we talked about cloud and a lot of things around that. This time we will much more focus on the connectivity part. So let's go. A lot of things that we talk about up here in the Nordics, in Sweden, of course, is the sustainability piece of the data centers. And I think, you know, over the years, I've always felt the data industry have thought about this, but it's always, in the end of the day, the cost that matters, and people have built data centers where they need to build them and not where they maybe should be built. Do you think that's because if you believe everything is just going to double, triple, quadruple over the next coming years in terms of data storage, where do you think that industry is heading in terms of sustainability? Will we see people care about where data centers are going to be put, or will data centers just be put where people live?
Well, I think both things, and that's the awkward balance that many of the data center builders are trying to maintain, is they're trying to build data centers as efficient. It's hard to call them sustainable as they are net new demand, even if they're, I mean, just because just building the cement, painting the walls, putting asphalt down for the parking lot is not a sustainable activity, right? I mean, you can make it more sustainable by using recycled materials or painting the asphalt white so it doesn't create as much heat. There's a lot of things you can do, but it's really hard to call a new data center something that's sustainable unless it's a net positive on how much energy is used, how much negative energy in the sense of a fossil fuel or whatever is being used. But that being said, any provider, even an enterprise provider, let alone a major cloud or service provider like an Amazon or a Facebook, has to consider is the success of the location from a performance and supportability standpoint. Yep. That's the first and foremost. Every time I was ever looking for a data center location, the first thing that I had to accommodate was, will the majority of the people using applications in that facility be able to successfully use those applications based on where I'm putting it?
Yep.
If that answer was yes, what's that circle look like? Right, from a circumference standpoint, within that circle, what's the best possible place from a cost of power, from a efficiency capability standpoint, because of climate, because of renewable energy resources that might be available? Mm-hmm. How do all those play in? But that first question has to be done; otherwise, the rest of it doesn't matter.
No, I'm right? That's really the way I see it as well. I just heard the other day that someone said, you know, the IT industry is afraid of becoming the new oil industry. You know, everyone hates the oil industry in some way, and therefore the IT industry was, you know, we don't want to have any headlines in the papers where it says that Amazon is consuming all power. You know, Microsoft is building a couple of data centers in Sweden right now, and there was a discussion, you know, will they consume all the power that actually we will need for all the automotives that's going to be electrified over the coming years and so on. So do you have that same discussion in US?
We do to some degree. I mean, the notion that, in fact, if you care to look it up, Jonathan Koomey wrote his last name is spelled K-O-O-M-E-Y. He and a few other people wrote a paper recently about the trend of power consumption in the industry, and it has some very interesting perspectives. I don't agree with it 100%. I would say I'm somewhere around 75 or 80% in agreement with their suppositions. But nonetheless, I believe they did great work. And it gives you some idea of the trajectory of power use and what some of the dynamics are for why we're not actually using more energy than we are already. Because if you were to talk to me or, you know, Christian Bilotti at Microsoft or, you know, Dean Nelson or Jonathan Koomey or Peter Gross 10 years ago, we probably all would have said, oh, by now we're going to be using 6 or 7% of power.
Yep.
Right. But the combination of efficiency being built into the environment, along with the vast improvement in the ability to compute on from a CPU and even from a disk drive standpoint, i.e. a lot more data on one disk that's also more efficient from a power use standpoint, a lot more compute on a much smaller chip, or smaller certainly from a power draw standpoint as compared to how much it puts out in compute capability, mean that we're almost staying even.
Yep.
Because of how those things are improving over time. Can we maintain that? It's hard to say, but I think, you know, whether we stay at 2% or grow to 3 or 4%, the fact is that it's an enormous impact, even at just 2%, let alone 4 or 5 or 6%. And the industry, I believe, needs to continue to look for ways not to whitewash, or as they call it, greenwash power use by buying PECs or, you know, trading or something like that. But in reality, the industry working more effectively at doing projects that actually replace existing demand build for traditional power supply, because, you know, it's ironic that if you put a data center in and you say it's using green energy, it is maybe. But if it's using the green energy, then that means all of the other industry or homes, wherever that data center was built, aren't going to be using that green energy.
No.
One way or the other, more power is being used.
Yep.
And so we have to find that balance. And it's a difficult thing. But I am pleased to say that more industry folks, meaning enterprises, are focused on this as a goal when they move into a data center or even adopt cloud. More investment firms are putting this as criteria on portfolios for stocks and ETFs and things like that. And certainly the cloud providers, I mean, I know many of the people that run the large data centers and cloud environments for the largest providers, and I know them personally, are very focused on trying to find economical and efficient ways to remove as much of the fossil fuel from their mix as they possibly can.
Yeah. No, you're right. And you mentioned Dee Nelson, and I know his work with iMasons, and I think it's a great work they're doing there, and they're really trying. And it's good that the biggest ones go in the front here, because that's where it needs to start. They're the consumers of the most. And speaking of them, really, you know, currently, if you think about the public cloud out there, there's really only a few companies that dominate the market completely. Do you see that as a problem, or is that a good thing?
I actually do see it as a problem, and that sometimes puts me in the crosshairs for people in the industry, because an interesting thing about the tech industry, especially in the very tech-centric environments like in Austin, Texas, or San Francisco, California, or something like that, is that many of us somehow believe that IT organizations can, technology organizations can't really do any wrong, right? Like they're, whatever they're doing, it's somehow a benefit to everyone, and you shouldn't argue with it, right? Just enjoy the warmth of the embrace and not, don't worry about the handcuffs that are being applied while you're being embraced. I personally believe that, and in fact, it's one of the drivers behind my own business creation. I personally believe that we need more competition in the market, and we need the ability to allow additional startups to make noise in the space. One, because there's plenty of opportunity. Now, when you start making $100 billion a year, another $10 billion looks like just logical next step.
Yep.
And yet $10 billion could make 20 other companies really, really happy.
Yeah.
Really, really happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And so to me, the notion that 4 to 5 cloud providers might own 60 or 70% of the globe's compute workload, they might in fact drive a similar amount of network traffic over their own networks.
Yep.
I see that as problematic for a number of reasons. One is that at some point, their growth and size will potentially make governments look at them and say, we have to regulate you, because not only is too much of the industry, which is a dollar figure we're worried about, running on you, but too much of our stuff is running on you. And we can't afford for you to make decisions based on finances alone about how you operate, right? So once regulations get put on it, what happens? Well, the same thing that's happened to power companies over the years, and that's that the competitive spirit, the innovative spirit, was sucked out of them like a vampire with a meal he hasn't had in 20 years, sucking the life out of another human. And so, you know, power companies have, for the most part, have little changed in most places, certainly in the U.S., for 80 years, because they haven't had a need to. And I'm worried that that same problem could occur in the cloud providers. And I also worry, you know, just like we've heard in other industries, whether it's, you know, an automotive industry company buying an interesting startup and then basically just killing it, or Amazon buying a competitive product and just replicating it itself. The ability to create new innovation, I think, is stifled significantly. So those are just some of the risks that I think are potentially bad for the market, and why I think certainly at the edge, we have our best opportunity to create some solutions and space. Yep. For new entities to develop.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting. And I also believe that you, and I think you mentioned it before as well, these guys know so much about us, so it's almost impossible to stop them right now, because they know the behavior of practically everyone right now, because everyone is using that.
You think about Microsoft or Amazon or Google, they have any number of vectors from a data standpoint of their environment that they could use to determine how good is Martin's company doing. Right? Which applications that drive revenue are being used more?
Are
they in general slowing down their cloud use, which would mean that they don't have as much business? I mean, any number of things. Where is more of their traffic coming from? So I know who their customers are. Yeah. Which one of their products has gotten the most noise in the market? I know that too. And those are all things that could drive them to create competitive solutions, charge you more, or make decisions on whether to buy you or not, which again, is a competitive advantage that puts them in a position to create monopolistic type environments as compared to any other company.
Yeah. Oh, that's a very interesting topic, and we can speak about that for a long time. But let's talk about something different. A couple of weeks ago, you spoke at a DCD event around companies that need to automate, and you said that you've seen an increase in automation during COVID-19. What is it that you've seen, really?
I've seen a number of things. I mean, I've seen the first and foremost, the supposition came from I attempted to validate it to some degree with people I know in the industry. But the first supposition I made was that if I, as a former CIO and head of infrastructure organizations, et cetera, was faced with this pandemic and was sitting around the executive roundtable, virtual executive roundtable, talking about how to mitigate the risk associated with the pandemic, I can easily imagine that one of the first questions that would be asked by someone, whether it was me or whether it was the CEO or the CIO or somebody else, would be, what's our biggest constraint?
Yeah.
And the obvious answer is humans.
Yeah.
We already know that to be true. And I'm not trying to say that because I think humans are bad. That's not the point. In fact, I still think that most of the transformation we can go through from an automation and digitization standpoint doesn't, in fact, replace humans, but makes us more effective at being able to deliver to customers, et cetera, instead. But that being said, if humans are the constraint, and we already knew that, the pandemic would have shone the brightest spotlight in the world on that constraint and created a higher level of priority for getting to the point where we've minimized that constraint as much as possible, right? Yeah. And so I made that assumption based on my own experience and what I would have done, and I validated it with some others. And then based on what I was hearing and what people were doing, I came up with an estimate of somewhere between 12 and 18 months taken out of kind of a 5-year window. So instead of having 5 years from my first prognostication on the subject, which started, I think, in 2019, was that most companies had about 5 years to make significant progress on their transformation journey. I think that that's changed now. And I think they maybe have three and a half years left.
Yeah.
Now.
No, I think that, and I, if I look at my company over here, I think you're absolutely true. There were absolutely things in the beginning when everyone had to work from home that we felt, you know, oh, wow, this one should, we need to do this much better in a much smarter way. And therefore, you know, we came up with solutions that we would have probably taken 6 months to come up with in a couple of days because we just had to do it. It was more or less panic and to just fix it. I also, you also said when you said this in the DCD event that you talked about that customers needs to be involved in that development. You know, most companies can't do it themselves. They should actually involve their customers in this development of automation. What do you mean there?
So there's a number of ways to look at that. I mean, one of the primary ways that I look at the digital transformation journey, or I, again, I say this way too much, but I prefer to call it a business transformation journey.
Yep.
Because if it's digital, we've been doing that for 50 years.
Yep.
Since we first connected a printer to a network, we've been doing digital transformation. So I prefer business transformation. But to me, as with almost anything that we do as part of a business, it should be with an eye on how it benefits the customer. Because if it benefits the customer, it benefits us, right? And so business transformation to me, of all of the goals, I mean, you could say, well, we want a more efficient supply chain. We want more automation on the factory floor. We want better marketing data. We want faster turn on customer feedback. We want more of a DevOps-oriented thinking around how the entire company works to get process or projects through to some level of completion or enablement. And in the end, what do all those things really mean? Well, they mean being able to more effectively support the customer. One of the best ways to support the customer is by keeping your product front and center with how the customer is using it or buying it and what they want out of it. So a key opportunity for almost every organization is to find ways to get the customer closer to product development and product management.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Right.
Do you have any good ideas for how to do that? Really?
One of the analogies that I like to use is think about the a corporate organization, an enterprise, as the body of a human. And traditionally, that body has relied on some very basic shouting from the rooftop type of ways of connecting with the customer for the most part. By the time they get information back and can act on that data, it's stale, it's not trust-oriented, it's not engagement-oriented, it's et cetera, et cetera. It's like somebody with no arms just yelling from one place, hoping to get feedback from a customer. Edge computing, on the other hand, and tools associated with business transformation are like adding arms and hands to that body. And what are hands good for? Now, of course, I'm thinking pre-pandemic, where hands are actually used on a regular basis to embrace people or shake hands, et cetera, et cetera. But what is the point of shaking hands? You and I meet for the first time and we shake hands. Why do we do that? We do it because it's respectful. We do it because it conveys trust. It conveys warmth. It conveys truth. All of those things.
Yep.
Right? Even potentially strength and domination. But one way or the other, the hand is a very important part of how we as humans, even here, I'm not going to be on video for the podcast, but I'm waving my hands all over the place.
Yep.
Like I'm talking about sending a spaceship to Mars or something. So the edge computing to me adds that hand and arm to the body that is the corporate entity and allows for greater connection with customers, greater trust enablement, greater integration, deeper partnerships, et cetera, et cetera. And so I see the speed up of digital transformation as directly relating to an increased activity at the edge as well, where people can create differentiation for how they work with customers.
Yeah. No, I think that's super interesting because, yeah, I really think so. You know, I think many companies are just using their Net Promoter Score once a year and they get a number and then they say, you know, customers like us 8. Right. And then it's like, all right, but you're right. We should really involve customers a lot more. Another thing I've seen, you know, I think in this pandemic, the sort of hashtag work from home or W8FH has been used a lot. But I know you talked much more about WFA, work from anywhere, really. What do you mean when you said that?
Yeah, so it may seem like an unimportant distinction to many, but to me, definitions can be very important if there is an underlying demand change associated with it, especially. And so when you think about work from home, traditionally speaking, the vast majority of people that might work from home, outside of people that are by virtue traveling workers, like a salesperson or a consultant or something like that. Work from home means that you're somewhere within 30 minutes of an office. And why is that distinction important? Well, that distinction is important because it means that if working from home doesn't work, where do you go? You go to the office.
Yep.
What happens when the office isn't there anymore? Where is work from home now? As a comparison to WFH, where is work from home? Well, if I lived in Utrecht and my office was in Amsterdam, then if the office was down, it might be a long drive. Or if the work from home was down, it might be a long drive, but I could drive into the office and work there. What if that office doesn't exist anymore? And there's maybe some small entity somewhere else, but I could literally be anywhere and working. How does that change the dynamic of my relationship with technology and my ability to function effectively? And my perspective is that as applications and environments continue to improve in how immersive they are and how performance-oriented they are, because it's been proven over and over again that the better performance you can apply to working to applications that customers interact with a lot during the day, the more productive those customers are. And I'm speaking both in external customers and internal customers as employees, that there's a direct correlation between dramatically improved productivity or the opposite, dramatically reduced productivity based on the performance of an application. So as those things become true, what does it mean to live anywhere and still be able to use complex application or work environments successfully from that anywhere, even if that anywhere is a lounge chair on the beach in Bali?
Yeah.
Versus a hotel room in the center of Paris.
Yeah. And I guess this will have a major impact to us service providers who
Absolutely.
Have to build networks completely different. You know, I think today the most of the traffic are in the downtown cities of the biggest cities where most people work during their daytime. And suddenly, you know, if no one is going to be there, you know, why have all that traffic there? So that's going to be a major impact to us as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's going to be a big, big change.
I mean, think about it from the average network, right? The average, but the average network today is effectively a hub to a hub to a bunch of spokes.
Yep.
Right. And there might be several hubs along the way, but it's, you know, it's center to a spoke to a town to spokes to neighborhoods to spokes to homes, right? As an example. What happens when the traffic from those homes looks more like 5G traffic instead of the spoon feed traffic that we have equivalent now going up network?
Yep.
Right? It's a very different dynamic on the impact for how those networks will be used and abused and the service provider's ability to provide some level of consistent service for what has become, if you don't have the ability to drive to the office, one of the things we haven't mentioned yet between the two of us is all of a sudden, 500 million, 700 million, a billion homes and hotel rooms around the world become critical networking access points.
Yeah.
They're no longer just best case.
No.
Right?
No, it's going to be really interesting. And I also hear in the corridors here that people are talking immediately right now about, shit, there's new traffic patterns out there. And, you know, we really need to change the way we do.
Yep.
Great. I think time is running out here, but I really want to thank you very much for being the first guest on our very first podcast here in Telia Carrier. So thank you very much, Mark, for being here and answering and a lot of new insights here. So thank you very much for that.
No, thank you very much. Honored to be the guest and really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
To you who are listening, thanks for tuning in and hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Stay tuned for the next episode of the Connectivity Podcast. And make sure, follow us on Twitter for updates. The handle is ConnectivityPod.